You're listening to Nick Luck Daily, bringing you the latest news and the best interviews from around the world of horse racing. This episode is brought to you by the Racehorse Owners Association, by Thoroughbred Racing Commentary's Global Rankings in partnership with the Saudi Cup, and by the Fitzdares Club. Good morning. Tuesday, April the 13th. Happily, the snow is melting away here in the UK and the sun is shining brightly in TW11 at the moment. I'm about to hop in the car and head to Newmarket for the first of their three-day Craven meeting. And with the Blue Bloods coming onto the stage and really beautiful horses being sold at Park Paddocks in Tattersalls over the next couple of days, it seemed a very appropriate day to, in our Round the World with Weatherby's Bloodstock segment, talk to Dr. Andreas Jacobs from Gestüt Verhof and Neusel's Park Stud, one of the world's most prominent business leaders. He's also part of a dynasty of thoroughbred breeders who have done so much to nurture the breed in Germany. It's a fascinating interview. You will enjoy it. We are, of course, still basking in the glory of Rachel Blackmore's Grand National. In a few moments' time, I'll be talking to Olympic gold medalist Sam Queck, who wrote a really interesting piece in the Daily Mirror yesterday, more of which in a moment. But talking of the Daily Mirror and talking of national treasures, move over. Sir Elton John, Sir Steve Redgrave, Dame Judi Dench, arise Sir David Yates, who emblazoned Manila Times all over the Daily Mirror's pullout on Saturday.
Yes, thank you. I've been at the Mirror 20 years, so a 7-1 winner, which was comply or die, and now an 11-1 winner. I don't think Mirror readers can say that they've been shortchanged when it comes to the world's greatest steeplechase. Yeah, I mean, it was a lucky guess, as we know. You put down about 5 or 6 horses that you think have got a good chance, and in this case, the right bingo ball dropped. But it's always a great thrill to pick the winner of that race. I'm not trying to be falsely modest, but as we know, there's an awful lot of guesswork and a lot of things to go right. So, but it was a great day. Much more important than the fact that I stumbled across the winner was a momentous occasion, as has been discussed, I'm sure, at length now, the victory of Rachel Blackmore. I think that pretty much everybody writing match reports on Saturday evening said, you know, this is what, the 173rd running, 182-year history, and I couldn't think of a more momentous chapter that's been written in that time. It was a privilege to be there, and I hope that it has ramifications for racing and beyond.
Well, we spoke yesterday on the podcast about how Rachel Blackmore has changed the game and might change the game, not just horse racing, but sport in general, and how she might be a role model for people coming through who want to excel and to be jockeys, opening doors, breaking down barriers. But I then read a piece in the Daily Mirror by a former gold medal winning Olympian hockey star Sam Queck, now a well-known television presenter and journalist, and it got me thinking that this was a whole wider subject that needed to be explored. Sam joins me now. Sam, for you, why is Rachel Blackmore and her profile and her victory so crucial?
I mean, it's huge. I mean, everyone obviously was talking, and she made the headlines, quite rightly, for being the only women to ever win the Grand National. And in terms of even women participating, the numbers are so low. But what I kind of noticed, and actually when you dig deeper, that's fantastic, but the main thing for me was I looked into the figures and stuff of why young women and girls give up sport, and some of them I was genuinely quite shocked about, and the rate of how many give up for various different reasons. But one of them, which again I looked at, I think that it was 72% of girls aged 11 to 21 said that the lack of media coverage of women in sport definitely affects whether they take part in sport or not. So I think her going on to win the Grand National, being on the front pages, is huge. It's huge for young girls and women all over the country.
And women participating in sport generally, that's it. And young women's health. I know that's something you were particularly focusing on in this article. And again, that wasn't something that had immediately occurred to me in the immediate aftermath of the race.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of people see sport, and probably more the female side of people, who think actually sport is, oh, it's because I need to look thin, it's because I need to look good for Instagram or Twitter and social media, but actually sport is just to stay healthy, to enjoy it, to socialise. And I think quite often it's the wrong perception of why we do sport. And it then got me thinking, like, obviously everyone knows the Kardashians and how significant they are on social media platforms, but actually I've never actually seen them even working out gear or getting sweaty playing tennis, playing football, hockey or basketball, whatever. And I just think it's just so, so important for young girls to get out there and start doing sport. I mean, I was at a shoot yesterday and I was speaking to a lot of people about the Grand National. And one of the ladies actually said to me that her young daughter's been inspired by Rachel Blackmore to get out there and hopefully one day become a jockey. And she's only five. She said, I want to be a jockey. So, you know, that's one of probably so many that, you know, saw her ride at the weekend.
And in terms of the way that she's got to where she's got, how much of an impact do you think that will have? I.e. that really she is still a woman in a male-dominated environment.
I mean, it's huge. I mean, you can't take away the achievement from any other jockey that have gone on to win the national. It's the same distance, it's the same fences. But ultimately, as you say, Rachel being a female is just huge. I think going forward, just like that example I just said, for a young girl to look and say, I can do that. But not only has she done it in, you know, a female field, like of, you know, tennis or a golf, but she's gone and done it amongst the, as we say, the lads. She's gone and beat the lads, you know what I mean? To say anything is possible. And she, as again, another cliche, she's gone on to break that glass ceiling. So it's so important. It's absolutely huge. And just to show people sport's cool. Do you know what I mean? And she's done all her interviews on BBC and other places this week, and she's looking fabulous and glamorous. So you can be both. You can be cool, you can be glam, but you can also, you know, get sweaty and have a little bit of spit on your face. And that's what it was like for me playing hockey.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned the Kardashians, and there was the furore last week, wasn't there, over, I think it was Khloe Kardashian had an unapproved photograph go out. And it was a perfectly nice picture of her, but because it hadn't been airbrushed and, you know, screened by her people and whatnot, then there was a big storm about it. That's quite depressing, really, isn't it? If you're looking,
oh, it's terrible. I mean, I think it was a good thing because people actually realise, oh, it is fake. I do talk sometimes, and I always make sure that I let them know that when I do a magazine shoot, this is what I look like. Then you have professional help from a stylist, makeup, and hair artist, and then on top of that, they airbrush you. So whatever you see is always fake. I mean, I think on Instagram, if you're posting, what, five pictures of you looking amazing, all airbrushed, photoshopped, you should always have to post one real picture of yourself because that's what people... It's almost, I think people like to see that because that is normal. I mean, even now me, obviously 6 weeks post-pregnancy with Molly, I've now got a young daughter and I am looking at these stats and I'm looking at society thinking, how am I going to make sure that she realises what's real and what's photoshopped? But then also, you know, how can I keep her into sport if actually socially some people may turn around and say it's not cool? I really just want to be a social influencer because I get more likes on my pictures for looking fabulous and all done up and potentially photoshopped. So for me, it's really important. I think going forward, something definitely needs to be done about it a lot more.
I think that's it, and I know I've digressed a bit, but it's a digression with a point because, as you said, it's about getting out there and enjoying sport, and it's something that's fun and it's something that's cool. Not everyone is going to achieve the highest standard. Very few people are going to achieve the highest standard, but that doesn't mean that people of a high standard achieving at a high standard aren't inspiring people to have a go.
Yeah, completely. Because again, that example I said, the woman told me that her daughter didn't even realize that women could be jockeys. And I remember when I chose between football and hockey, I never even knew that you could be, I mean, the only time hockey was ever on the telly was at the Olympics. And even then it probably wasn't, it was, you know, way down the list of what was to be broadcast. But I didn't even know until the age of 16 that I could do hockey full time. And then, I remember even before then, I didn't even know hockey was in the Olympics. And then, you know, once you get into it, and football now is brilliant. I mean, I had two teams to choose from when I was younger, whereas now there's tons and tons of them on, you know, on a Saturday and Sunday. You can see young girls running around everywhere. And it's just showing girls that you can do that sport. You can play that, you know, play that game or do whatever you want because it is available and it's there to have fun. And all that you say, make it cool. Just make it cool. You don't have to be a social influencer to aspire to be them. You can aspire to be one of the best jockeys or one of the best athletes in the country.
Sam Quick there. And Dave Yates, some interesting perspective there.
Yeah, it was a very thought-provoking piece, Nick. And it reminded me of a conversation I had pre-lockdown with some friends, which I suppose must be about 12, 13 months ago now. And it was ventured by one of our group that the photographs of sports men and sports women portray them in very, very different ways. The argument went that when there are pictures of a sportsman, they are striking a ball, either a tennis player or a football player, and that those pictures are taken in the heat of battle, essentially in action. Whereas the pictures of sports women tend to be much more passive, that they are receiving a trophy and smiling. And the point that the person was making was that this fell into line with our the way that the genders are generally portrayed in the media. And that hadn't occurred to me at the time, but I think the person, I think the argument holds quite a bit of weight. In terms of Sam's piece, she talks about the statistics of females dropping out of sport and how they relate to the figures of female obesity. That's obviously very worrying, and it's directly related to the fact that there is a general lack of female sporting role models. So that's one of the reasons why Rachel Blackmore's victory is so important. I know that she's not comfortable, as she said many times, really discussing the gender issue. But that doesn't mean to say that in the media, by people like us, that she can't be portrayed as a female role model and a very positive one. And there's much work to be done in racing, as we know, but I know that the thrust of Sam's article was more about the health of the nation, and it's a very important piece in that sense. There's one final point I would make, and that's about, Sam made a reference to BBC interviews. Well, it's now it's approaching 3 days since Manila Times crossed the winning line at Aintree, and neither trainer Henry de Bromhead nor jockey Rachel Blackmore has been made available to the written press. And I include in that the racing press, the wider sporting press, the even wider news press, and sort of lifestyle, if you will. If this message is going to be communicated as effectively as possible, and we want to project female sporting role models, we want to get young women doing sport, we want to bring obesity levels down, then that method of communication is something that has to be addressed.
To a rather drier subject, Dave, but in terms of our smallish world, one that's quite important, particularly at the moment, and it is a hot topic, Britain versus Ireland, Ireland winning hands down, stop the fight. Is there something badly wrong with the handicapping system? Because Chris Cook from the Racing Post wrote a story this morning saying that Britain's jumps handicapping system is to be examined for fairness to establish whether it might be, and I'm quoting Chris here, handing a systemic advantage to Irish runners following all the success at Cheltenham and in the Grand National. How do you read this?
Well, there was definitely a meeting at Aintree, an informal one, between some top trainers, and I can't give you all their names because I don't know the exact identities, but there was definitely a meeting between some trainers and BHA Chief Executive Julie Harrington about how the British and Irish runners were handicapped and about the Irish success at Cheltenham and at Aintree. I thought the problem at, and I realise it's only British people who would recognise it as a problem, I thought that might take a back seat during Aintree. But if anything, I thought that events there brought it into sharper focus. You had Belfast Banter moved up from a handicap win in the county hurdle to win a grade one. The Shunter would have moved up from a Cheltenham handicap to win a grade one if he jumped any of the last three fences. Then there was the National, obviously a handicap, where one by one, the British trained runners cried enough because they couldn't keep pace with their Irish foes. I think the first thing that should be done is, not necessarily as a trial, but I think that the unified handicap system is something that really ought to come into being. It's a very strange circumstance when we get to Cheltenham, and the British handicapper is effectively marking the Irish handicapper's homework. And on many occasions, he thinks that his Irish counterpart has got those Irish horses too low. That's why they run off marks that are 3 or 4 pounds higher than they would carry it home. Now, that in itself is not satisfactory. I think that a unified system should come into place. Now, of course, the likes of Belfast Banter, the Shunter, Mount Ida, Heaven Help Us, and Tronador, all handicap winners at Cheltenham or Aintree, they would have still won under a unified system. So that might be the sticking point. I think that whilst it's worth trying the unified system, which I think we all believe will give the Irish runners more weight on their backs, the results of many races at Cheltenham and Aintree suggest that whilst that's worth trying, it's not going to provide the solution we're looking for.
Exactly that. I think you could have added £7 to every Irish trained runner in the Grand National, and whilst the result might have been somewhat different in intricate detail, I think the broad picture would have looked largely the same, and I don't think you'd have got any more than 3 UK trained finishers, which is a major problem. Switching codes, Craven meeting starts today, Tuesday, 3 days now, as it traditionally always was. Dave, what are you most looking forward to?
Well, I suppose just really looking forward to seeing where the home train runners lie with regard to the first classics of the season, the 1,000 and 2,000 guineas. Aidan O'Brien has already got a strong favourite for the 1,000 guineas in Santa Barbara. He's got Battleground and some St Mark's Basilica, who are popular, of course, for the 2,000. So, yeah, well, we've got guineas trials this week, haven't we? Both at Newmarket and then, of course, on Sunday at Newbury, because that's been put back 24 hours. So we'll know where we stand after that. We've also got the Scottish National, of course, at Ayr on the Sunday, which will be a fascinating race in its own right. But basically, I'm just looking forward to see if we're going to take another hammering at Newmarket at the beginning of May in the 1,000, 2,000 guineas.
I feel no doubt that that is the likeliest outcome. And just finally, for the moment, betting shops opened again in the UK yesterday. Hurrah!
Yeah, obviously that's a picture that's been very different over the last few months, with betting shops as non-essential retail being closed. But with step two of the four-step roadmap out of COVID-19, betting shops opened again on Monday. And so, yeah, very much a welcome development. We had a Grand National where everyone was betting online only by a couple of days. But, yeah, it's another step back to normal and a very welcome one at that.
Well, it is Tuesday, so we go around the bloodstock world with Weatherby's and their Stallion book and, of course, their excellent Global Stallions app, in which and on which you will find all the stallions stood by Dr. Andreas Jacobs and his family at the Gestüt Fairhof in Germany, at a Main Chance in Western Cape in South Africa, and at Newsells Park, of course, and you've heard from Julian Dollar on this series before. I'm very pleased to say that Dr. Jacobs is with me now. And just looking at your career of significant note as a international businessman, it did strike me, how on earth do you have time for racehorses?
Well, I grew up with horses, so that was always my evening or my weekend desire to be with horses. And so I was able to adapt my calendar, work on Monday to Friday for a chocolate business and other companies, and of course enjoy the horses over the weekend.
And when you're breeding horses and running big stud farms like you are, it's not as though this is something you're just dipping your toe in. It is and I've talked to so many people on this slot, it is an experience of total immersion, it seems, for most people. Does that apply to you?
Yeah, I'm very emotional with horses. I have, of course, the ones I love the most. But in the family, we always looked at very good leadership, being responsible for running the horses. And you mentioned one, and a key person, Julian Dollar, who runs Newsells Park Stud. And we try the same in the two other studs in Germany and South Africa, so that we don't have to get involved in the details and can enjoy really looking at horses, looking at the mating plans, trying to invest in the right stallions and so on.
Take me right back to where Gestüt Fairhof began with your late grandfather, Walter.
Well, we have been warm blood riders, and at some stage he felt that warm blood is probably like Formula 3, so he wanted to go into Formula 1. And so he invested in thoroughbreds. That was in around 1960, 60 years ago. And he started investing in very good English mare lines. And subsequently, we were the first, and I think, champion breeder in 1977. We've just celebrated our, I think, 18th champion breedership in the last year. for Germany. So we built a very nice, in the beginning, owner breeder and now more commercial operation.
Does it give you quite a bit of satisfaction when you hear people in Britain and France and Ireland talking about how they want to get hold of some good, strong German blood? You feel the kind of circle has turned a bit? Because I hear that an awful lot.
Of course, it gives satisfaction. Recently, also with a lot of interest from Australia. I think the key base for this is that we breed very sound and very tough horses. Basically, because in the history, Germany was an owner-breeder country, so the owners wanted to have a horse that lasts long and races for 3-4 years. Look at Akatenango, for instance, a horse we bred. He was champion horse 3 years in a row, and he won a lot of pattern races over a mile and a half. That's the other element to it. 80% of the German Group 1 races are mile and a half races. So if you go into long distance Melbourne Cup type or even international hunt, then of course German blood today with Monson Sons is very, very popular.
Why do you think the influence of Monson has been so important? Because this is another strand, another sire line that's now developing a key influence of its own, not just jumping but flat as well.
Well, I think the beginning of all this probably was a horse called Surumo, which my grandfather bred, and he was born in 1974. And he became 6 times champion sire, multiple, maybe 7-8 times broodmare sire in Germany. And he's the broodmare sire of Monson. When you look at Monson's pedigree, it's not really special, but he was a good horse on soft ground, over a mile and a half. Later, we bred a horse called Lomitas, who was equally a very good broodmare sire, and also today is a good sire for, or broodmare sire as well, for horses over jumps. And that's all based on what I said earlier, on toughness, on, you know, lasting at least 3 years, and of course, the mile and a half distances that they're challenged on.
So the reputation of German bloodstock is, I think, very strong internationally with all those names you mentioned and the success of the Dane Dream, Scirocco, Manduro, all those horses. How is the racing scene domestically at the moment, and what challenges does it face with you at the moment?
Well, first is, of course, the COVID-19 related challenge, which is lowering price money. But if you exclude that and look at pre-COVID, German racing is significantly under pressure, basically because betting in Germany is very tiny. There's not much history of betting. Everybody is running to the tote for the lottery, but not for betting, horse racing. So the price money is low, maybe a third or 40% of what it is in France. Subsequently, German-trained horses are racing in France, a lot of them over 20-25%. So there is a big pressure. And that, of course, caused the number of foals born to go down. We're currently probably expecting this year to have maybe 600-something foals. And you can imagine it's very difficult to fill the races and have a proper diverse race catalog. So that's why the pressure in Germany is huge, and that's why we're all looking at investing in France and in England.
You've made a significant splash in South Africa as well. I note that it's almost 20 years to the day since you bought Main Chance in the Western Cape in South Africa. How much pleasure has developing that out given you?
Yeah, you're well informed. So it was an afternoon in Cape Town when I sat down with Graham Beck, who sold me this farm. It was in April 14 in 2001. The farm is a beauty. It gave me a lot of pleasure, because I also introduced a stallion from Germany called Silvano. At that time, of course, not knowing that he is becoming a superstar. And so the pride of the farm and the enjoyment of being there is very much connected with the success of Silvano.
And not just South Africa either, but your impact has been most notable in the UK, and the success of Newsells Park, which we mentioned at the beginning of the interview, has been noted particularly for Nathaniel's exploits under both codes. But Enable is the great champion that every stallion needs.
Well, we are extremely proud of Nathaniel being the sire of Enable. Of course, that carried him to the next level. He's a very stable sire. I mean, the demand for him is stable, and his crops that are post-enabled, so to say, are only coming out now. So we will hopefully see, and we expect to see, some very good horses to come. But I also like to mention, without parole, who's sure. with us since just this year, first season, exceptional St. James Palace winner, a lot of speed. He's very well recognized, and we're very happy to be in partnership with Uguntus there.
Of course, you've got Frankel connections everywhere there, because we know that Frankel and Nathaniel's careers were inextricably linked. We know that Without Parole is by Frankel as well, so a nod to the greatest racehorse I think most of us have ever seen. It's a relatively small concern. When I say small concern, I mean relative to the massive stallion stations where people are standing 30 and 40 stallions around the world. Is a boutique operation something that you've really tried to cultivate, to keep it quite select across all your farms?
Well, it's a quite delicate exercise that we're doing across all the farms, which is, on the one hand, we're trying to keep our very strong brood mares, the blue hens, alive and invest in them. On the other hand, we're a commercial stud, and at Newsells also with a significant number of boarders. So it's a dual strategy almost, I would say, and that makes it very challenging. But in our heart, of course, sits the keep and the protection and the fostering of the blue hens, and with Shasti at Newsells and with Waldmark and their daughters at Newsells, I think we have a great number, great quality. The same in Germany with the Sarumo family and many other families, including the Silvano family. And the same, of course, at Main Chance, where there's families on the farm that are there since the beginning, since the foundation of this farm. So we really look after those, and we're not shy on investing in good stallions when we look at the matings of those.
You mentioned those two blue hens. I want to talk a little bit about both of them. Shasti, first of all, I don't know whether to call her a blue hen or a golden goose. It's quite remarkable what she's done. She's done in the sale ring. When you first started breeding her, I mean, what did you imagine? Were you confident that she could be something like this?
Well, first of all, she was one of the last mares that was acquired by my father when he was still alive, and that's why we always looked at her with a special twist in our eye. I loved the family from the beginning because it's a very solid French-raised family, and so we felt a Danehill mare's solid background, good brothers on the track, I mean excellent brothers on the track, and she needs an investment. And we were a bit lucky that we had access to Galileo, and that of course made the trick. Now, I mean, the foals and the yearlings looked wonderfully, but they also raced very well with Japan and Mughal, and that was, I mean, a dream come true.
Would you, in an ideal world, would you like to stand one of her sons at stud yourself?
Of course.
And is that a possibility, do you think?
I hope so. It depends on the owners.
Wow. I hope you can. It would definitely complete the circle a little bit, wouldn't it? Given what we talked about in terms of the importance of strength and stamina in the blood. And we talked about it last week, actually, on this show, when we were talking about Japanese racing and how well that is doing, and the reason being because they bought stallions who can run and are sound.
Yes, that's correct. They buy a lot of German horses as well. It's quite interesting that I believe from the last 20 Oaks winners, German Oaks winners, there's probably 13 or 14 standing in Japan, and that should give you a bit of an idea of what they have in mind. Mm. Also, the good news about standing a stallion that you bred is that you know very much his family. You know, you can trace it back 7-8 generations, and that helps you hugely with matings, the characteristics of a horse. And that's why, I guess, my experience based in the German breeding, I'm very happy to see that replicating with horses like Waldmark, Wald Lerche, Wald Geest, and so on, and at Newsells Park.
So you take us to the other family I wanted to talk about, and it's had a notable result this week. I realise it was Pontefract, and it was in the middle of the week, but Waldkönig could yet become a pretty smart horse, the jockey Rab Havlin said, He won't be seen in too many handicaps again after this. He looks as though he's only just scratching the surface.
Well, it's probably best to talk to Gary Coffey, our racing manager, about it. But I was very proud to see him racing, winning the way he did. Of course, it was a bit of a test to see how he can move up. We didn't want to make it too difficult for him. But I'm sure you're going to see him in the group race next time out.
Yeah, and this, of course, is the family of Waldgeist, your ARC winner. That was an interesting day, wasn't it? Because there was the connection with Nathaniel through Newsels, and you bred the winner as well. An amazing array of emotions, I shouldn't wonder, that day in 2019.
Well, 2019, the ARC win was very special, also because of our partners, Dietrich and Isabel van Bötticher from Amalanstad. They're very long-term partners, and we've been discussing horses since 40 years. When he started, he sent all his mares to our stallions in Germany, Surumo and Akatilango, and he was always very loyal. So we had a great partnership over many decades, and so this culminated in a German horse. I mean, a horse that was bred in England but with German roots, and in this partnership, that was an absolute fantastic day. And we were lucky to have our families with us, so they could sense the beauty and the emotions of winning such a race, and hopefully that carries the studs to the next generations.
I get a strong sense talking to you that you feel like you're a custodian of this enterprise, and that it's just very important for you to leave it in as good or better shape than you inherited. Is that how you feel?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I took over from my grandfather in Germany not to change what he did, but to continue the legacy. And my father, who died way too early, who started Newsels and remains the founder and the spirit of Newsels. I feel the same as does Julian Dollar, who is doing an amazing job there. And for Main Chance, this is a bit of the South African stud is a bit of a kind of a fun exercise, because actually my wife and I started dating when she worked in Cape Town, so that's a kind of a way back to where we started, and in combination with horses, my passion.
And it's lovely that three generations should be all so passionate about not just the sport of thoroughbred racing, but breeding thoroughbred racehorses. How optimistic are you for the future of the sport as a whole globally? It's a biggish question, I guess.
Well, I think on the breeding side, there's no doubt that the countries, especially England, Ireland, and have shown that they're an amazing ground for breeding, for very passionate quality breeders. And I said, I think 10 years ago, I said to Julian, hey, I think we got to see times when England becomes a net exporter of racehorses. And I think this happened last year or the year before, first time, and that will continue. Why? Because the world, the thoroughbred and racing world will grow, especially in Asia, and they will look for quality. And so I feel for the breeders in England that the time will go on. We will see quality horses coming from England racing all over the world, and people in Asia and around the world seeking to buy horses from Europe. So I'm relatively optimistic. Of course, we have to get a tote in place. And I mentioned country Germany and Italy, where things are not doing well. But France had a rebound under the new management of PMU. And so I'm quite confident that three, four countries in Europe will carry and pull the bandwagon of thoroughbred breeding and racing in the world.
Dr. Jacobs, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Nick. All the best.
My thanks there to Dr. Andreas Jacobs. Best of luck to him and to all the Newsels Park stud team and the Gestüt Verhof group for the remainder of the season. David Yates is still with me with a tip for today.
Yes, Nick, I go to the 2:45 at Newmarket, the opening day of the Craven meeting, and the Pat Smullen Memorial Handicap, a race that honours one of the most popular figures of the weighing room, certainly in my time in the sport. I'm going with number 2, Hort Sadar. A 66-1 shot when third in the Lincoln, behind Hakiki, of course. It's surprising that he went off at those odds, given his form of last season. I think he can go two places better here in what looks a less competitive race. So 2:45 at Newmarket. It's number 2, Hort Sadar.
David, thank you very much. Thank you for listening. It's the first day of the Craven meeting at Newmarket. Craven Breeze up sale tonight. Don't forget the Tattersall's Bloodstock Bulletin. We had episode 8 on the podcast last night. It'll be episode 9 uploaded tonight as well. But for the moment, that was Tuesday, April the 13th. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with Fitzdares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.